This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. It was in December that the first hint of news came out of China. By January 3rd, passengers arriving from the Wuhan airport to Singapore were being screened for the coronavirus. By the middle of January, it claimed its first victim, a 61-year-old man in Wuhan. On January 30th, the U.S. reported its first domestic case. And as of today, 90 countries have reported coronavirus cases. The death toll is just under 3,400, with infections approaching 100,000. So this virus is moving fast. It's what some of the strains of influenza do so well. And it's causing a lot of comparisons with other outbreaks, like the great flu pandemic of 1918, which claimed somewhere between 50 and 100 million lives. All of this got us thinking about the comparison. Just what is the difference between that outbreak and this one? For several years now, viral disease experts have been talking about how another devastating pandemic is coming, that it's not a matter of if, but when. But is the coronavirus that potential pandemic? And what has changed in the last century? Dr. Jeremy Brown says quite a bit, actually. Not the virus itself so much, but how we treat it, what we know about it. Dr. Brown is with us today to talk about the lessons we learned from 1918. His book is Influenza, The 100-Year Hunt to Cure the Deadliest Disease in History. Dr. Jeremy Brown is an emergency physician, director of the Office of Emergency Care Research at the National Institutes of Health, though we should make it clear he's not speaking to us in his official capacity with the NIH, but rather as a private physician and as an author. Dr. Jeremy Brown, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. Good afternoon.
I want to begin with a story that you tell in your book. Before we start talking about the broader questions here, because I think it's quite interesting, it's the story right at the beginning of the book, a woman by the name of Autumn Redinger, young woman in western Pennsylvania. She's hit with the H1N1 influenza virus. This was back in 2013. Talk a little bit about her story and explain why you began with her, because I guess the point of it is that Autumn's fate would be far different in 1918. She was helped, of course, with medical technology.
That's right. You know, when I was thinking about how to open this book, I had to tread very carefully between describing influenza as a common disease that for most of us is nothing more than an inconvenience, and that's a very accurate description of influenza, and also describing it as a potentially deadly disease, which does claim many thousands of lives, and that's also an accurate description. And Autumn's story really rung true for me because it's the story of a healthy woman, mother of two, who went out for dinner one evening towards around Christmas time and came back and didn't feel quite right. She was texting with her friend, and her friend noticed that the texts were gibberish. Her friend went over, arranged childcare, brought Autumn to the local hospital where she received excellent emergency care. And although all of her tests appeared normal, the emergency physician had this hunch that there was something not quite right, gave her antibiotics, admitted her. By the morning, her condition had rapidly deteriorated. She needed to be put on a ventilator, and she was then flown by helicopter to Pittsburgh, to an academic center in Pittsburgh, where very rapidly she declined still further. By this time, of course, she would have been dead 100 years ago. She would have long since expired. Yeah. And at the medical center in Pittsburgh, an ECMO specialist, that's ECMO is called, ECMO is a extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. It's a medical technique. Basically, it's a heart-lung machine.
Right.
And it takes over the job of the lungs and of the heart. And Autumn's lungs were filled with fluid by then, and her heart was stunned by the virus. And so she was put on this ECMO machine as a sort of a Hail Mary last-ditch attempt to save her life. If that didn't work, nothing would. She was connected to this machine by large cannula in her groin and in her neck, and she hung there between life and death for several weeks until she pulled through, thanks largely to the support of her family, to the expert care that she received by the nurses, physicians, and therapists there. And she recovered. And I spoke with her a couple of times and with her family. And to this day, she sends a Christmas card thanking her physician who put her on ECMO and took care of her. And she realizes just how lucky she is. So there's an opening story that I think captures how dangerous influenza can be to healthy people. But of course, we just need to remember that for the vast majority of us, it's not going to come to anything like that, and it will remain just a nasty inconvenience that we get year after year.
Is it helpful, that comparison that we hear all the time, that frankly we're making today between 1918 and today? Is it useful?
Well, I think to a degree it's useful, and let me explain why. I think, first of all, there are some similarities between the influenza of 1918 and the new coronavirus that has emerged, COVID-19.
Right.
First of all, 1918, we know, was a bird flu virus that spent some time in an intermediary host. It was probably a horse or a pig, and then emerged and crossed over into humans and caused the outbreak that we now refer to as the Great Flu Epidemic of 1918. So it crossed over to us from an animal reservoir. And we know exactly the same thing happened with coronavirus. It appears to have originated in bats. It spent some time via an intermediary host. In this instance, it was the pangolin, a very cute but very endangered scaly anteater, and then spent some time in that host and emerged with recombined genes and infected us. So first of all, both emerge from an animal reservoir.
Right.
The second similarity is that both are winter viruses. Neither seems to tolerate warm or humid conditions. That's why the 1918 virus disappeared in the spring of 1918, and that's why every year flu disappears as the spring comes and the weather gets warmer. Unfortunately, in 1918, it disappeared in spring but came back with a vengeance in the fall. I suspect coronavirus will also become less of a problem as the weather warms up, but we simply don't know whether it will return in the fall. And the third similarity between the two, I think, is this, that both very quickly became a worldwide problem,
yeah,
as you so well pointed out in your introduction, regardless of where the virus originated. Now, there are three possible explanations or origins of the 1918 virus. One suggests that it was homebrewed right here in the US of A, in Haskell County, Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
A second theory puts the origin of the virus in 1918 in northern France. And a third theory puts it in China. There are strengths and weaknesses with each theory. But wherever it originated, it rapidly spread around the world. And of course, we know where the coronavirus originated, and it too has spread very rapidly around the world. So looking at these similarities, that they originated from an animal reservoir, that they're winter viruses, and they became a worldwide problem very quickly, I think there are some similarities. But of course, as we'll discuss, there are some very, very important differences, and those are key.
Yeah. I mentioned that we're you know, viral disease experts talking about, you know, for years they've been talking about the fact that a devastating pandemic is on its way. It's just a matter of when. And you say in your book that you wrote 2 years ago, we don't know when or where the next pandemic will occur, but it will, in fact, occur. Is the coronavirus that pandemic that you had in mind?
Well, I think what I had in mind then was more of the devastation,
right,
that we know influenza brought. And I think it is clear that is not what's going to happen today. And in fact, it's fairly clear that it's very unlikely to have the kind of mortality that the influenza virus caused. And we can talk about that in the show. Look, there are essentially two camps in the prediction world. One says, look, influenza of 1918 was a one-off. It only emerged from because of very specific conditions at the time. We've had 100 years. When I wrote the book, it was the centenary of the influenza outbreak. We've had 100 years, and yes, there have been periods where there have been outbreaks here and there of both influenza and other viruses. But overall, we see nothing like it because it's not going to happen again. Those are the optimists. There's a pessimist camp, which basically takes the same facts, looks at the same history and says, you know, each and every year we stand on this precipice. And the fact that we haven't been subject to a new epidemic is really that we've just dodged another bullet and we managed to get by another year and the big one is going to come. So I think here you see that indeed both camps are right. We now are faced with a worldwide outbreak of a virus. But, and this is very important, there are very important differences between what happened in 1918 and what is happening today.
Yeah. Let's back up, though, because an important part of your book is the history of the virus, how it works. And I wanted to spend some time with that. Let's talk about the history. You mentioned viruses were here long, long, long before we were. They've been around for millions of years, as we understand it.
That's right. And there's even evidence that viruses are actually part of our very genetic makeup. We know that our DNA contains sections that appear to have been injected from viruses over millions of years of evolution. So in many ways, viruses are part and parcel of who we are as human beings.
You also say they exist, this is how you put it in your book, on the edge of life, that they challenge our definitions of what it means to be a living thing.
Yes, we talk about viruses being killed by certain hand lotions or soaps.
Yeah.
And we talk about viruses living on us, but a virus is simply an inert bag of chemicals. Essentially, it's DNA or RNA wrapped up in a little bag, as it were, a little plastic bag, just sitting there waiting. It can do nothing by itself. Viruses need a host in order to replicate. And over millions and millions of years, they have evolved to do just that very well. They sneak into the host, they capture the genetic machinery of the cell, and they use that to trick the cell into replicating more and more baby virus particles, as it were. As that replication takes place, the virus mutates through just the process of being replicated. There are natural mutations. Fortunately, the overwhelming majority of viral mutations are not in the virus's best interest, and the virus is unable to go any further. But every now and again, a mutation that is makes the virus either more deadly or better at doing its job of infecting somebody, sometimes that evolves, and we get a new viral a new viral outbreak. Now, that's one way that the virus hijacks the cells and replicates. But it's also important to note that not only does the virus change through mutations as it replicates, but sometimes the genes of various species of viruses intermingle and swap. And that's indeed what happened with the great influenza outbreak. We know that a bird influenza virus somehow intermingled with another set of genes, probably, as I said, a host as a pig or a horse. And it was that switching or changing of its genetic structure that enabled a novel virus to emerge. And we think that's exactly what happened with the coronavirus, that it somehow swapped its genes with an intermediate host, and you got this new, more concerning and more deadly virus.
Yeah, that you explained the viral proteins. They assumed this. It's like an entirely new structure. You mentioned the analogy I really liked in your book is that helped me understand this. Is you say, think of a criminal who makes convincing disguises. Explain that to us, because it's like this virus has this invisibility cloak that it's I kind of like thinking of it as kind of dastardly and clever in some ways.
It is, isn't it? But it's not really an invisibility cloak, because the virus is there in full daylight, as it were. It simply understands, and again, we're going to use all these anthropomorphic terms, but
right.
The virus understands how our immune systems are built. We have an amazing immune system that recognizes the enemy, whether the enemy is a fungus or a bacteria or a virus. And once it understands what the enemy looks like, it makes antibodies against that particle. The problem is that the antibodies are only good for a specific kind of, in this example, a virus. So if you have made, as I use the example in the book, if you have made antibodies against a virus wearing a yellow jacket, you're only going to recognize viral particles in whom the jacket is yellow. And you can have a viral particle that has mutated or has changed its genetic structure to now be, for the sake of the analogy, to now be wearing a black coat. And now your immune system is not able to simply recognize it, even though it's standing there. And of course, the process begins again as it now, as the immune system now builds up antibodies to that new viral particle. And so the problem with influenza is that it keeps doing this, and we keep changing and chasing the last influenza outbreak, not being able necessarily to produce something that will that will be a vaccine for all influenza. I mean, if you think about it, we are all encouraged to get a yearly influenza vaccine, and the contents of that vaccine change year to year, depending on what the scientists believe will be the circulating influenza strains of that year. Now, we don't do that when we get our mumps, measles, and rubella vaccine. Right. We get those as children, and we are essentially immune for life. The difference is that the influenza virus changes its outer jacket so quickly that we can't keep up with it, whereas these other viruses, the mumps, the measles, and rubella, don't change their structure, and we are able to recognize them. Mm-hmm. And sometimes our vaccines are so good that we can completely eliminate a problem like we have with smallpox. We have eliminated that problem with vaccines. We can't do the same for influenza because of its very clever ability to change its structure and to therefore hide in full daylight from our immune systems.
You say this in the book, the flu virus is perfectly evolved to stay one step ahead of our immune defenses. And it made me wonder, so do you think, doctor, that we ever get to a point where we will figure this out? Or do we, because it seems like a chess game in some ways. Through drift and shift and gene sharing, influenza can morph faster than our bodies can profile it. So will our systems through evolution ever figure it out as a proper way? Or will there always be this give and take, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, based on past experience of millions of years, our systems, our immune systems are only able to recognize antigens that are presented to them.
Yeah.
The bigger question, I think, here is, will we be able to come up with a vaccine that is broad enough that will turn on our immune systems against any possible configuration of the influenza vaccine? And will it cause us to have an immune response that lasts not from year to year, but lasts several years? This is the holy grail of influenza vaccine research. It's, you know, a universal flu vaccine that scientists are working very, very hard in this country and across the world to try and come up with. Because wouldn't it be wonderful if we can get a once-in-a-lifetime flu shot that then keeps us immune for the rest of our lives, like with our MMR shots? Unfortunately, we're not there yet. And viruses, we often say you can't beat Mother Nature, and there's a lot to that. You know, Mother Nature is awfully clever. I think one other piece of news or thinking that we might want to consider here is that many times it's not in the best interests of a virus to be particularly deadly. What I mean by that is that if you think about it from the perspective of the virus, and as we said, it's really an inert bag of chemicals, but let's give it a brain for a moment. Okay. The virus wants to replicate. That's all it wants to do.
Yeah.
If the virus is too deadly and it kills people straight away before they've had an opportunity to cough and to spread the little baby particles of flu virus, the virus is not going to spread very far. So what a good flu virus would do is it would get into the human body but not really do too much damage. That way it would be coughed out without the host being too sick and spread in that way. So in many ways, it's not in the best interests of whatever disease it is out there that's troubling us, that's attacking us. It's not in the best interests of that disease to be, you know, to cause too much sickness. Of course, nature doesn't quite work like that, but I think you get the idea.
Yeah. Dr. Jeremy Brown is with us. He's an emergency physician, director of the Office of Emergency Care Research at the National Institutes of Health. We should also point out, as we have been throughout the show, he's not speaking to us in his official capacity with the NIH. His book is Influenza, The 100-Year Hunt to Cure the Deadliest Disease in History. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
What's it like being the rabbi at the largest synagogue in Salt Lake City?
They said, no, who's like above you religiously? And so I was like, God? And they went, oh, and they went home and told their parents, our next door neighbor is the Jewish prophet.
Rabbi Samuel Spector from Congregation Kol Ami, and much more this week on Preach. It's a special episode recorded at our very first live show. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So just what does the coronavirus have in common with the great flu epidemic of 1918? You're hearing that comparison a lot these days, and it can be terrifying that 1918 flu infected hundreds of millions, killed tens of millions. Dr. Jeremy Brown is with us to talk about that outbreak and this one. His book is Influenza, the 100-Year Hunt to Cure the Deadliest Disease in History. Dr. Brown, I wanted to come back to the history of all of this because I find it really interesting. Where did the name influenza actually come from?
The name is a remarkable testament to just how little we knew about the disease. We first hear about that name in around the 1500s, and it comes from the Italian term, the Italian word meaning influence, influenza. And it points us to this idea that the cause of this disease, and of course influenza has been around for many thousands of years at the very least, so people came down with influenza-like symptoms even though they didn't know what it was actually causing it, that the original thought was it was caused by a misalignment of the planets, that Saturn and Jupiter were somehow misaligned or lined up in an inauspicious way, and that caused trouble down here on Earth. And so we are now stuck with this name influenza, but it reminds us that originally we had no idea what was causing the disease, and the best we could come up with was that it was something to do with astrology. But you know, we also had some other very weird ideas of what caused the disease. As we went into the 1918 epidemic, other theories that were out there were that it was, as I said, an influence of the planets, that it was effluvia boiling up from the earth in volcanic eruptions, that it was the rotting carcass of dead animals. There was a theory that had that was out actually in the late 1890s after another influenza outbreak, a more minor one, that it was all caused by tainted Russian oats. So even 100 years ago, it seemed that the Russians were being blamed for everything. And and another theory was that, you know, it was the weather. And so I think what you really have to understand here is that we had no idea. Of course, we only discovered in any real meaningful way viruses around the 1930s, although the word virus was used for many centuries prior. It just simply meant a poison. But we only really understood what viruses were in the 1930s and only took a picture of the first flu virus in the 1940s with the advent of the electron microscope. So the word influenza really points to this idea that for a long, long time, we had no idea what it was that was causing this terrible pandemic. And that's really why I called it the hunt to cure the deadliest disease in history, because over time, certainly with the 1918 virus, but if you add up all the fatalities that we suspect there were over history, by far and away, influenza is the culprit, is the cause of the deadliest disease that we as humanity have experienced.
You mentioned the Greek historian Thucydides, who wrote what seems to have been, he seems to have been writing about what was an outbreak in 430 BCE. What do we know about that outbreak? That seems pretty bad.
This was an outbreak during that Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta, and around 430, a terrible three-year plague broke out, and many people who had then migrated as refugees into the city of Athens to take shelter and protection succumbed to this disease. It was terribly overcrowded, much in the same way as the ships taking our troops over in the 1917 and 1918 in the Great War were terribly overcrowded. And there is a description of this disease by the historian Thucydides when he described an overwhelming fever in the head and redness of the eyes, and many other suggestions that this epidemic, which incidentally killed about a third of the 13,000 troops stationed in Athens, that it seems to have been influenza. And in fact, a group of researchers suggested that this group of symptoms should be called Thucydides syndrome, and they suggested it may be the earliest, at least historic record that we have of pandemic influenza, probably complicated by a secondary bacterial infection. So certainly for as long as we've been recording history, we have known about influenza, and we may not have called it that name precisely, but we've been well aware of the terrible seasonal disease that comes through out of the blue and takes such a toll.
Interesting, it was connected to war. Is there something to that?
Well, I think it was not so much the connection with war, but the connection with overcrowding and with poor sanitary conditions. Yeah. I think those are the key issues that we see here. During that time, war does terrible things to people. It crowds them together. It makes sanitary conditions, washing and keeping clean, very difficult. And that makes it a perfect breeding ground, not only, of course, for diseases like influenza, but when following a natural disaster, we often have an outbreak of cholera that is caused by overcrowding and, more importantly, very poor sanitary conditions. So I think that was the key.
You write about the first influenza pandemic in modern time. I guess this was 1889. What do we know about that one?
Yeah, there have been several influenza pandemics or epidemics, depending on how you depending on how you count them. But, you know, in the late 1890s, there was an outbreak of influenza in Great Britain that actually prompted a parliamentary inquiry by the time it was all over. And I think the story that I tell in the book really points to a very clever bit of historical work that a physician by the name of Parsons did. He wrote this parliamentary report, and he tried to understand the cause of the disease. And as I said, many theories were floating about. He said, well, let's look at the British railway system. Let's look at absenteeism in the British railway system. There were two main theories that he was then considering. It was either caused by something that is transmitted person to person, or second theory was that it's caused by something in the weather, something in the air. Of course, we know influenza is really a bit of both. So he looked at two groups of employees of the British railway system. One were the ticket clerks who worked indoors, but of course were handing out the tickets as they were bought. And so they were face to face with many people who were surely coughing and sneezing over them, but they were indoors. And he compared their rate of absenteeism to the rate of the engine drivers and engineers who were out in those steam-driven locomotives. They were outside all the time, but they were not really around people. And he looked and he compared the rate of absenteeism in those two groups, and he found that it was the ones who were indoors, the clerks, who were more liable to take time off for influenza. And so this pointed him to the suggestion, and at that time it remained only a suggestion, that there was something not in the atmosphere, not in the weather, that you didn't get influenza from walking outside, but you got it because you were in close approximation, you were close affinity with somebody who was perhaps carrying whatever it was that was causing the outbreak. And I think you go back to the 1890s, they did not have the same techniques by any means that we do, but a clever piece of detective work using readily accessible and available data pointed clever Parsons to the suggestion that this came through interpersonal contact.
Well, you have clever people like Dr. Parsons and clever people like James Herrick, another doctor who we can talk about, who were really up against a lot of quacks and folk remedies. And you write a bit about that. Talk a little bit about some of the treatments that kind of crazy ones, bloodletting you write about, overdosing people with aspirin. Just say something about that, if you would.
Well, dosing people with aspirin was not as crazy as some of the other things. I have a chapter in the book called Enemas, Whiskey, and Bloodletting, and
right.
I think that really points to the state of the art a century ago. Let's take them one by one. For whatever reason, enemas were thought to be good for people with any kind of disease, and they were readily prescribed, sometimes to a ridiculous degree. So those were readily prescribed. Whiskey was thought to be of help, and hey, you know, I'm not gonna suggest you shouldn't have a drink after a difficult day at work, but certainly did not to the degree that it was prescribed. The chief British medical officer at the time thought everybody should have a glass of dry wine every evening. That was the best advice that he could give. And so you had enemas, you had whiskey, and then you had this terrible thing called bloodletting. And it is exactly as it sounds. There was a theory that remained mainstream medical practice from the time of Hippocrates and the time of Thucydides that we've just mentioned, all the way through to the great flu outbreak of 1918. And the idea was that if you cut open the vein and bled blood out of a body, disease would go away. And so you went, when you felt unwell, you went to the bloodletter, and that person would slice open your vein, take a certain amount of blood out, and there was a lot of science to this. So the question was, should you take blood from the right side of the body or the left side of the body? Yeah. It depended on your symptoms, how much should you take, and so on. And that was what was done. Now, before I began my research, I thought this was a thing of the past, that it had fizzled out in the 16th, 17th, maybe in the 18th century. And I was sitting doing some research one day when I came across an account of British soldiers who had tried bloodletting on soldiers. Now, this wasn't in 1918. This was in 1916, 2 years before in another outbreak in northern France. They had tried bloodletting on their own troops who had come down with the complications of influenza and were suffering from severe pneumonia. And the physicians went on to describe what they did, and they said in their report that, hey, you know, if it didn't work, it was probably, ready for this, it was probably because we didn't do it early enough. Not that it didn't work, but we didn't do it early enough. Such was the belief in this system called bloodletting. And where did they publish that report? They published in a journal that is published to this day, a very reputable journal in Great Britain called The Lancet.
Yeah.
And the word Lancet comes, of course, from the device that would open up blood and let the blood come out. So those were your options, enemas, whiskey, and bloodletting. And we have a lot to be thankful for that we don't live in those kind of conditions today.
You mentioned your favorite example of some of these folk treatments from something from 1936.
Yes.
One influenza patient and was gassing, the idea of
yes.
gas.
Perhaps I'll just mention it. This comes from the record of 1936. So we're now, 18 years post the 1918 virus, right?
Yeah.
We're in 1936.
Yeah.
We know already what viruses are. And this comes from the nursing records of an influenza patient, which was saved as a family heirloom and actually published in a very reputable medical journal 70 years later by physicians who were descendants of this person. And here's what this person went through. Over a period of 3 weeks, he was treated with a punishing battery of balms, mustard plaster, which is a home remedy rubbed on skin, aspirin for fevers, codeine for cough, phenolphthalein, which is a cancer-causing laxative, cough medicine, camphorated oil, seven enemas, rectal tubes, don't ask me about rectal tubes,
yeah.
Milk of magnesia, another laxative, God help him, urotropine, a bladder antiseptic, and tincture of benzoin. He also received 5 doses of whiskey, as we mentioned. Yeah. Everybody was thought to benefit from whiskey, and 14 doses of castor oil. And actually, his 7 enemas may have been medically necessary because he was given at least 39 doses of codeine, which suppresses coughing, to be sure. Codeine does suppress your cough, but it can also cause constipation. That was state-of-the-art treatment, not in 1918, but in 1936.
Now, not everyone was practicing this questionable medicine, of course. You mentioned, I referred to James Herrick, a doctor who was one of the first, you say, to challenge a lot of these ideas. And Herrick wrote something that I think may bear repeating, and I wanted to ask you about, that one of the hardest things to do in the treatment of infectious disease is to refrain from prescribing drugs. Would you say something about self-restraint? Because I thought this seemed important to you.
Yes, it is important. And, even to this day, I'm an emergency physician by training. And when I was training residents, very often there's a life and death situation that we have to make in emergency medicine. But that's unusual. I know it's the scenes that we see on the TV of emergency medicine dramas. But the vast majority of cases that we get in emergency medicine, we don't have to act immediately. And I would very often try and remind residents, sometimes you have to stand back and look and don't make a decision. And sometimes the decision you make is, I'm going to make a decision down the road rather than decide now because I need more information. And even today, I think there is a place for that in medicine. We don't always have to give something and prescribe something. Sometimes the best thing to do is to wait and look and see what happens. And, you know, you mentioned this physician who really tried to remind people that what we should be doing is sitting back and watching and not giving people these very unusual or even if they were accepted state-of-the-art remedies that really didn't stand the test of time. And the best thing sometimes to do is to sit back, think about things, and provide the patient with the best remedy they can. You know, the famous physician Osler was said to remind people that medicine is the art of distracting the patient while nature affects a cure. And now, surely today we know that's not always correct. There is much that medicine needs to do to try and take on Mother Nature head on. But very often we can remind ourselves that this thing, this disease, is very likely to get better without an intervention or with an intervention. I might often tell my patients who have a clear viral infection, look, you're going to get better from this virus. You can get better with antibiotics, or you can get better without antibiotics. Antibiotics do not treat viruses. So why don't we make a decision together that will work? And I think that kind of approach is an approach that really helps physicians and the patient as well to understand not only the benefits of medicine, but the limits of medicine. And even today, with all the amazing things that we can do, ECMO machines that take over the heart and lung of patients who are sick with influenza, and all the amazing antibiotics and antivirals we have, we are still very much at the mercy of Mother Nature.
Before we head into a break, I should ask you about chicken soup, because you love chicken soup, you confess, and it works. It doesn't cure things, but it works pretty well for the symptoms anyway. It's not bad, I guess.
It's not bad. And I opened that chapter on whiskey and enemas with an admission that I am a fan of my dear mother's chicken soup. Growing up in London in those dark, rainy nights, I look forward to it. And actually, there was a wonderful paper that I found published many years ago now in 1978. And let me tell you its title. It was title is almost as delicious as soup. The title is Effects of Drinking Hot Water, Cold Water, and Chicken Soup on Nasal Mucus Velocity and Nasal Airflow Resistance. And this was a doctor who had decided to feed people as a hot water, cold water and chicken soup. So there was a placebo arm, if you like, or an inactive arm. And he paid these healthy volunteers to see how much it changed in congestion. And he suggested that while hot water was good to clear your stuffy nose, chicken soup has an additive substance that does the job better. I'm not sure if that's actually true, but certainly keeping ourselves well hydrated, warm fluids, whether they be a tomato soup or a chicken soup, warm fluids do ease the nasal congestion. And if chicken soup is the thing that's going to get you through your influenza, then hey, more power to you. Enjoy it.
So I wanted to come back to that. You mentioned that we have three ideas about where the flu of 1918 came from. One in France, you mentioned, one in China. I want to come back to the idea that it may have started in rural Kansas, or in that was the sort of epicenter for this. Talk a little bit about that story. You mentioned Dr. Loring Miner, a country doctor in rural Kansas, starts to see these really serious cases of influenza, and he writes a report to health officials. So what do we know about Kansas as being ground zero for that?
Yeah. Kansas, as I said, one of at least three possible ground zero for the influenza outbreak. So put yourself now in the mind of a country physician in 1918. Dr. Miner has an enormous office, a rural practice that covered about 850 square miles of flat farmland and about 1,700 patients. And this was in Haskell County, a square of land in Kansas. And in January and February, Dr. Miner notices some of his patients were coming down with influenza, or what he referred to then as a disease of undetermined nature. Mm-hmm. And one day in January or February of that year, 18 people fell ill and three of them died. And in a sparsely populated county like Haskell, this was enough for Dr. Miner to make a note of it. And he published a couple of months later in a journal this outbreak of a disease of undetermined nature in Haskell County. And that certainly is among the earliest, if not the earliest, reports of influenza in the United States, of this outbreak of pandemic influenza in the United States. What's important, I think, for the story is not only that it's that it may have originated here in the U.S., but what happened very soon after that, which was that some 300 miles to the east, there was a military camp, Camp Funston, and soldiers from the camp visited their family back in Haskell County and came in and out. And soon after that little outbreak of civilians, the influenza broke out at Camp Funston, and very quickly it reached epidemic proportions within the camp and then spread from there to other camps, both later that spring and then again in the fall. So it may well be that ground zero was in the American heartland. As I said, it's one possibility. There are strengths and there are weaknesses with that idea. But certainly there was something going on in Haskell County. If the disease didn't originate there, then it was certainly recognized in a very early way there.
You mentioned, we were talking about war earlier, and you mentioned how many patients were crowded into these shared military wards, separated by just flimsy cotton sheets. So that idea of crowding people together, clearly that was a big contributor to all of this.
It is, and especially when we know today, and even back then, as I said, people had a sense that this disease was spread by contact. There are many signs that you can find from 1917 and 1918, large signs put up saying no spitting in public. And we even have records of people who spat in public to clear their throats and were arrested for doing so because it was against the public health regulations of the time. And it was actually a very sensible regulation. And yes, there are these pictures. One of them is on the cover of my book. These enormous gym-like rooms in which the patients are separated sometimes by a sheet. On the cover of the book, there's a picture. There's no separation at all. And they're coughing and they're sneezing over each other. And the nurses are walking in between. And it's really a wonder that the death rate wasn't in some ways higher. In fact, there is some evidence that the death rate was particularly high in the military, perhaps precisely because of these very crowded conditions. Public hospitals certainly didn't exist to the degree that they exist today and very quickly became crowded so that the majority of influenza patients would have been treated at home. Now, that was probably a good thing. They avoided their doctors with their ideas of enemas, whiskey, and bloodletting, and they probably survived precisely because the doctors didn't get their hands on these patients. So, yes, there are these very dramatic pictures, and we also have eyewitness accounts of these wards that were full of these poor, poor men coughing and trying to fight against this terrible, terrible influenza.
I wanted to point out, as you do in the book, that the flu outbreak of 1918 did create this impetus and some momentum for what you describe as a steady stream of these dramatic medical discoveries. I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. Talk about the discovery made in 1933. This is the first sort of recognition of something called a virus, I guess.
That's right. As I said, you know, we have this word virus that is used in the literature for many hundreds of years, and it means something poisonous.
Yeah.
So we certainly understood that there was a mysterious thing called a virus, but it wasn't until the 30s that there was really good evidence of transmission using filters. Basically, scientists actually in London, not far from where I grew up, scientists filtered basically the nasal secretions of patients with influenza, and they filtered out all the obvious bacteria, so that something that was much smaller than a bacteria had to be, was left. And they then used this to infect ferrets. Ferrets were very good guinea pigs. The other very good guinea pigs for a flu model are, in fact, guinea pigs, which are used as guinea pigs.
Yeah.
And they actually showed in this way that we can filter out all of the bacteria, and something is still in these secretions that causes the disease. And that's where they got this idea of a virus, of a tiny thing. And viruses are at least 20 times smaller than bacteria. And as I said, later on, using the early electron microscopy, we got a picture of an influenza virus. And of course, today with the coronavirus, many times articles published on the coronavirus will have a picture of the coronavirus, which incidentally is given that name because because it appears to be like the sun with a bright corona or around it, sort of shining around the virus particle. And so the very name coronavirus points to the fact that we're able to see the virus today and name it on the basis of what it looks like. Mm. Something, again, that would have been simply inconceivable 100 years ago.
So we've learned its genetic code. We know how it mutates. We know how it makes us sick. But you say we still don't have an effective way to fight it. Why is that? Why isn't there a cure for the flu?
Well, I think I would just sort of qualify your statement. We do know how to fight the flu. We do know how to fight winter infections. And this is true today as it's true 100 years ago. Washing our hands, staying away from others when we're sick and covering our faces when we sneeze. Certainly no spitting in public, please. These are good ways to prevent the transmission of the virus. We know that the influenza virus, like many winter viruses, is exquisitely sensitive to heat and to warm conditions. So if you turn up the heat in your house and put a humidifier on, you're creating conditions that are not ideal for the flu virus. Mm. So we do know, at least in terms of its transmission, how to reduce, certainly can't eliminate it, but how to reduce it. But you are correct. We are still fighting this battle. We have some antiviral medications. They're not terribly good. Even the people who believe that they're useful will admit that we need better antivirals. And, of course, we are still looking for that elusive universal flu vaccine, because we know that the only way to stay ahead of influenza is to develop a vaccine that will be good against all possible variations and mutations and novel viruses. That's what scientists are doing there. They're trying to find that part of the flu virus that remains constant despite mutations. And so they're focusing in on that and seeing if they can prime our immune systems to laser in on that constant part of the flu virus and therefore develop immunity to it. It sounds really simple, right? Mm. It sounds really simple. Yeah. Instead of focusing, let's say, on the color of the jacket that the flu virus is wearing, a black jacket or a white jacket, let's just make it sensitive to anything that is a jacket. It sounds so easy, focus on something that doesn't change. But unfortunately, it has remained elusive, although we should point out that there are some early clinical trials of universal flu vaccines currently going on.
Doctor, I wanted to ask you, you say in the book that we can act to prevent another pandemic. But to achieve this, you say, that we have to consider this critical question. And the question, you say, isn't just about medicine or science or policy. It's about our collective memory. What do you mean?
Yes. So, I live in beautiful Washington, D.C., a city that is architecturally stunning, and there are monuments everywhere. And as I was writing the book, it occurred to me that we don't have a national monument to remind us of the influenza outbreak of 1918, a monument not only to the victims, but to the heroic doctors and nurses who in many times took their own life into their hands, offering hopefully not whiskey enemas and bloodletting, but comfort and compassion. Mm. We don't have a monument to that outbreak. There are some in other countries, although not many. 100 years ago is a long time. It was in many ways a completely different world. But we don't remember, I think, the lessons of influenza and the influenza outbreak until it happens again. And so we've had outbreaks of flu in 1976, and we had 2009, and more recently we had an outbreak of Ebola. That is a very different virus to influenza. It's not a winter virus, but it came to this country. And, of course, now the current outbreak of coronavirus. Again, it's not influenza, but it's similar in terms of it being a winter virus. And I think we really need to put this kind of battle that we have against viruses in our forefront, perhaps a memorial or a reckoning, something in our nation's capital that would point to what happened and help us bear in our collective consciousness that perhaps those who say, you know, we just dodged a bullet this year because there wasn't an outbreak, perhaps they're right, and that we really need to keep our fight against these diseases front and center, even when, and this is important, even when they're not in the news, even when the scientists are working quietly in the background and it takes money, even when they're doing that and people might say, why are they spending their money on these funny little viruses that don't seem to be causing problems? The reason they're doing that research is because we never know where the next enemy will come from.
That's Dr. Jeremy Brown. His book is The 100-Year Hunt to Cure the Deadliest Disease in History. Dr. Brown, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Ale Vallart, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.